This is Alfred Hitchcock speaking. In the past, I have introduced you to many kinds of people. Murderers, thieves, swindlers, many of them geniuses at the business of crime. Now I'd like you to meet an entirely different person, an average sort of fellow.
And show up at the
First things first. Welcome to Zizek and so on. This is a Patreon episode. Clearly, you know what's going on, but we got Michael, Will, and Peter here.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How we doing, fellas?
Good, mate.
Good. Yeah. Still reeling from the Will Smith episode, but you know, I'm taking some chance to grow and to change.
What's the wife's name again?
Jada.
Jada. She says that we've entered a season of healing after the event. Whatever the fuck that means. I've decided that now whenever I make a bad joke and someone has a negative reaction, I'm like, hey, whoa, it was a G.I. Jane joke. It's so funny because your reaction is like, as if that's what Will Smith had a problem with. That movie reference is too old.
Yeah, we're talking about movies today. The 90 whatever Academy Awards, which all of us certainly did not see.
Yeah, I didn't even know they were on until that happened.
And then all the movies that won, I haven't seen either.
Nah.
Yeah, they looked really bad. They looked terrible. Like Coda, like that musical one. I guess the Academy Awards loves musicals and deaf people. It's funny to react like to a movie like Coda winning, like, oh, finally some representation for deaf people. It's like they've been dealing with themes like that in film for a very long time.
Yeah, like Rear Window is about a disabled guy. That's what the movie's about, yes. Right?
Yeah. Sense of a Woman about a blind guy. I've never seen it, but
so we're doing our long. Is vaunted the word? What does that mean?
That's like heralded.
Yeah. Long vaunted.
Hitchcock episode. I mean heralded in the like on the other end of it. We're not heralding the coming.
Oh, I see.
Heralding the greatness. But I guess heralding would be a better word than vaunted.
Hear ye, hear ye.
Forthwith.
We're doing our Hitchcock episode, which we said we would do, I think, on our first episode.
Yeah, when we did those weird introduction things to give Jake a little job.
It was a make work program.
Make work for Jake.
Yeah, so we've read a chapter in Looking Awry.
Yeah, the Hitchcockian blot,
which I know I say this every time. Fantastic essay.
Really good.
There's something to the Zizek guy, I think.
He's all right, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, every time like I read him or like see like the clips from like Perfect Guide or something like that, I'm always like, wow, Zizek is quite good.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed watching the Perfect Guide's clip today.
Yeah, yeah. It took on a really new, distinct, like, flavor after the essay.
Yeah, 100. And also, like, who else would do that? Like, recreate the actual scenes and stuff. Like, people take themselves so seriously in academia.
Yeah.
And then Zizek just does the fucking stupidest shit.
And he's like, my God, I'm thinking like Melanie. You know what I'm thinking? I want to fuck Mitch.
I'm keeping these coughs in here, by the way.
Yeah. it's not a laugh track. It's a cough track. But yeah, it's like that is not a joke that probably any other academic would make.
I noticed, Michael, your cigarette pouch has a toilet on it, which is a nice instantiation of Zizek's claims about ideology, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yet another ideological function of the toilet.
And Hitchcock's got a big thing with toilets. He was asked why he never has done a costume film. And he said, because you could never make a costume film where the actors have to go to the bathroom.
Interesting. Do any of the movies feature that?
I'm not sure. I have a ton of Hitchcock anecdotes that I can pepper. Pretty strange dude. Way more intense than I realized.
Yeah. How so?
Yeah. Like, he did a lot of pranks, but like pretty intense pranks. Like, he once bet a film's property man a week's salary that he'd be too frightened to spend a whole night chained to a camera in a deserted and darkened studio. The chap heartily agreed to the wager, and at the end of the assigned day, Hitchcock himself clasped the handcuffs and pocketed the key, but not before he offered a generous beaker of brandy, the better to ensure a quick and deep sleep. The man thanked him for his thoughtfulness and drank the brandy, and everyone withdrew. When they arrived on the set the next morning, they found a poor man weeping, exhausted, and humiliated because Hitchcock had laced the brandy with the strongest available laxatives and the victim had soiled himself and a wide area around his feet and the camera.
Oh, my God. Fucked up.
Dehydrated on the floor in a puddle of your own shit when all of your peers walk into the room.
Oh, my God.
He gave to Tippi Hedren's daughter, Melanie Griffith, when she was 5, a miniature doll of her mother dressed as the character from The Birds in a tiny coffin, dead. Yeah. He was a strange fella.
So Zizek starts off the text we read today with talking about the kind of like fundamental gesture of Hitchcock's movies, which is, he says, he affects a perfectly natural and familiar situation, is denatured, becomes uncanny, loaded with horror and threatening possibilities. As soon as we add to it a small supplementary feature, a detail that does not belong, that sticks out, is out of place, does not make any sense within the frame of the idyllic scene. First off, an interesting definition of Pointe de Capitan.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Which normally we think, I guess, a la Y theory, as more in line with a kind of master signifier function.
Mm-hmm.
But I think here, Pointe de Capitan maybe is more similar to Objet A.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually.
What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, because Lacan drops Pointe de Capitan for master signifier.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a pure signifier without a signified, mm-hmm, that allows for, what is it, the diachronic structure of the language, a language of difference, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But the point is that it's a feature that sticks out or juts out that then frames the rest of the signifiers.
Yeah, the meaning that needs to be interpreted, that juts out of the regular flow of the scene, or
but this is why I think it's more similar to Objet A, because it's in the, like, Zizek talks about how it kind of, like you just said, Michael, sticks out, and he says we're in the realm of double meaning. And I guess that, you know, you could talk about master signifier in those terms, but the fact that he's talking about here kind of like an uncanny supplement, a stain, I think it brings it closer to an Objet A.
Interesting thought. And so, like, starting off, he talks about how Hitchcock is often reproached for his phallocentrism. I believe, Michael, you were reproaching him for that very thing last week. you were like, although it was meant, wait, never mind. And then I was like, although it's meant as a criticism, this designation is quite adequate. That was my response. Yeah, the feature which sticks out.
Zizek says it's actually someone apt to call to note Hitchcock's phallocentrism, particularly because of his name.
Very good. Yeah, for some reason, when I read that sentence each time, I was just thinking of an erect penis. I was like, yeah, that actually makes sense. So they have, Jesus talks about like three successive like kind of modes of
libidinal economy.
Yeah. So the subject's libidinal economy. You got the oral, the anal, see last week's episode, and the phallic. So we can just quickly describe each one.
Yeah, so he says the oral stage is the what he calls the 0 degree of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the kind of like, you know, really old slapstick films, silent films, mm-hmm. The effect of naturalness they produce in this in their apparent direct rendering of reality.
Yeah, flat and metonymic with no montage.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like we devour it with our eyes. It's not suggestive of anything other than what's going on the screen.
Yeah, it's homogenous, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting though that the oral stage is silent here?
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And it's and Jesus makes an interesting point. It's like the illusion of film, the kind of fundamental illusion, is that it gives you the impression of a natural flow of things, but mm-hmm. there's always something missing from the action. There's a hole that you're never seeing.
Right.
Yeah. And along with the oral stage, it's about partial objects that then engender this desire for something beyond the screen.
Right.
So in the oral stage, it would be the breast.
Okay, then we've got good old anal stage. This is where montage enters, he says. It's the, you know, the fragments, multiple aspects of the action. It's not singular in the way that the previous stage is. Mm-hmm. There's still this illusion of continuity, but a continuity that isn't kind of complete.
Yeah, the entrance of metaphor into film.
Yeah.
What first came to mind was that Russian film, I Am Camera or something like that. Do you know that one that I'm in?
Yeah, yeah. It's the
Man with a Camera.
Man with a Camera.
Man with a Camera, yeah. That's a cool one.
Yeah, so anal is horizontal and flat and metaphoric. So you got the parallel montage.
Yeah, Zizek talks about some hypothetical horror scene where there's a family eating dinner and there's a group of robbers outside, and then we can imagine like the cuts between the family eating and the robbers mm-hmm. entering the house, and these two things together create a kind of anal scene.
I thought it was good that he related it with the function of metaphor, which is something that we probably should have drawn out in our last episode. I think we did touch on it through that quote where Zizek is talking about that shit always kind of stands in for something else, like the thing as such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's something about a surplus knowledge is created in that scene.
Yeah, shit stands in for something else, but sorry, continue.
You'll know, Pete, from the opening scene of the new Batman, where you see in the window of like of the apartment, and at first you're wondering if there's like a robbery going on or some sort of assault or whatever. And it's from you don't know whose point of view you're seeing it from, with the deep breathing. Well, because it could have very easily been Batman, right? Because you don't know what incarnation.
Oh, I
of
forget.
Batman
I
you're
actually,
getting.
I actually thought it was Batman. Is it Batman?
It was the Riddler.
Oh, right.
Because he goes in and kills.
Oh, right. Anyway, Batman, good movie. People should see it.
I haven't seen it yet. Hey, I'm a person.
Pretty much.
Maybe there's a bit of a Rear Window shout out in Batman.
There's that redoubling, right? Like you're aware of something that they're not aware of, but there's an uncanniness to it.
That and like you keep getting this like above shot of the scene below, and then later that angle itself becomes vital to the plot because the perspective. Yeah.
We'll get there.
Yeah. No spoilers. So, that was close to a spoiler, but it wasn't. I walked the line of a spoiler there.
Okay.
And then we get the anal stage. Or sorry, the phallic stage.
The phallic stage transposes this flat horizontal doubling of the action onto a vertical level. The menacing horror should not be placed outside next to the idyllic interior, which is the example that Peter was just citing, but well within it, more precisely under it, as it's repressed underside.
The suspicions of the characters, their guilt, their implications, what is not directly represented in the scene, but is suggested by it.
Yeah. So in this scenario that Zizek is creating of these robbers outside preparing, you know, to rob this family in the interior, he says the Hitchcockian iteration of this would be to have no one on the outside and to have a member at the dinner table be the element, the disruptive element to the apparently idyllic scene. So he finds
a vial of poison, right? Mm-hmm. That he then becomes suspicious, and then the entire scene takes on a new meaning. And that's what he means by a vertical doubling. So there's a change where the action gets repressed or internalized or subjectivized.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware of it. He's aware of it. And then it creates this surplus.
Yeah, where everything becomes suspicious.
And and that's precisely when you, the viewer, kind of become like implicated in the scene, because you know as well, you and the perpetrator are kind of in a similar position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that's the looking awry, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You want to explain that?
So that's the anamorphosis. Oh my God. Anamorphosis.
Yeah. Anamorphosis.
But basically that, if back to the point to Capitan, that there's something that sticks out, something that juts out, that shifts the meaning of the scene.
Yeah. So it's not like, and it's not depicting reality like in the oral stage, apparently. The reality itself here is like becomes the site of repressed desires, for instance.
I'm trying to think of a filmic example of this, because there's just so many, but my mind's blanking.
But the point is that we are included in the frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A good example that Zizek echoing Lacan's example of this is Holbein's, the ambassadors, you know, the guys chilling with all their stuff, and then there's the skull on the floor.
Yeah. Anamorphs.
Yeah.
Wherein the subject becomes a dog.
So with anamorphosis, it's that the gaze involves the spectator in the image.
Yeah.
So it's the point at which the spectator loses their distance, say from the painting,
mm-hmm.
becomes involved in what he or she sees.
Yeah.
Because the form of the figure changes on the basis of the spectator's position.
Mm-hmm. But and it also opens up an abyss of the search for a meaning. He says, "Nothing is what it mm-hmm. seems to be. Everything is to be interpreted. Everything is supposed to possess some supplementary reading." Which, going to the phallic stage example of the Hitchcockian scene, the dinner table.
Yeah, it's this element sticks out, and renders the subject of meaning kind of like palpable and necessary to understanding the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Rear Window is a good example of it, right? Like, so I forget what's the character's name in Rear Window?
Jeff.
Scotty? Jeff?
Scotty. Scotty's in Vertigo.
Vertigo, okay. In Rear Window, Jeff becomes part of what he observes. So he has to confront the question of his own desire. Like, what does he really want?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, in like basically from the first scene of the film, there's a love interest, or like at least the failure of a love interest. Why he turns down Grace Kelly is beyond me, but
she's considerably too young for him.
Oh, not in the old way, you know. James Stewart was actually a very attractive man.
Those were the days when that was pretty
good.
Yeah, that was the days when the ideal love pairing was a young woman and an old virile man.
Yeah,
those were the perfect pair.
Yeah, Rear Window is a great example of how this fascinating object that drives the interpretive moment of the gaze, which is not indifferent, but which demands this sort of movement of interpretation.
Yeah, my note was, Rear Window is ultimately about old mate not wanting to fuck the chick.
Yeah, so, that's what Zizek says. Yeah,
yeah. So Zizek's main point with Rear Window is that Jeff is diverting his libidinal economy
impotent
towards the window because he can't fuck
consummate the relationship.
Yeah,
yeah.
But then I thought, I mean, this was, I thought, such a great interpretation of the things that he's seeing in the, mm-hmm. the windows through the back, are just kind of like a display of like the various possibilities of his relationship with Grace Kelly or non-relationship with Grace Kelly.
Yeah.
So you have like the single blonde woman who's
the lonely heart, Miss Lonely Heart, Miss I think lonely he calls heart. Her in the film. Yeah.
But she's dances, she sees men, you know, kind of on her own whim. She seems self-possessed, these things. And this is like Grace Kelly's character without James Stewart's character.
Mm-hmm. Zizek writes, the rear window is essentially a fantasy window. Incapable of motivating himself to action, Jeff puts off indefinitely the sexual act, and what he sees through the window are precisely fantasy figurations of what could happen to him and Grace Kelly.
Mm-hmm. So then, like, there's the...
There's a couple who are going to fight. Kind of still to, yeah.
Yeah, they argue. You know, that's obviously one of the potential trajectories of their relationship.
There's the eccentric artist.
Yeah. They could spend their time together like the ordinary couple with a small dog, yielding to an everyday routine that barely conceals their underlying despair. Or finally, he could kill her. But then there's this great, I thought this was one of the best moments of this essay is he talks about the inversion of Bentham's panopticon here.
Oh, yeah. It's really cool. Yeah.
As exploited by Foucault, he says.
Yeah. he needs to be like, yeah, it wasn't Foucault who thought of this. It was Bentham.
So instead of the panopticon described there, which is like, you know, the gaze which emanates from the central tower, you know, on the cells, which yeah. can be seen through at any time. And the people in the cells have this feeling of the gaze imposed on them. And the, you know, it doesn't matter whether or not the gaze is there. It's inverted so that the people being looked at by James Stewart's character are indifferent to his gaze. And really, he's the one that feels this domination of mm-hmm. this panoptic, you know, weight on him through his own
subject position. Yeah.
That's
why when the neighbor, like when they finally see each other at the end, the thing is like, what do you want from me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is it that you desire?
Yeah, it's like
It's like in The Simpsons where Bart is doing the rear window thing. I mean, one of the windows he sees is Jeff.
Yeah. He's like, hey, Grace, there's a weird kid in the window. Yeah, man. On the contrary, it's Stewart himself at the center of the panopticon. It's all pervasive eye who is terrorized, constantly looking out the window, anxious not to miss some crucial detail.
Actually, brief aside, Zizek commenting on Hitchcock. First of emotions, he says, like, anxiety. This is in reference to Freud, but anxiety is the only emotion that's authentic. Clearly, what is one of the brilliant elements of Hitchcock is he's able to capture anxiety so well.
Oh yeah, that's really nice. But Zizek draws out in Rear Window something that's easily missed. Which he uses it to draw into a point that he's making about a couple other Hitchcock films that we'll talk mm-hmm. about in a minute.
That of the maternal superego.
The disembodied voice. Can anyone remember what that is?
Yeah, it's like it's the operatic voice in Rear Window.
It's the woman singing scales, and you never see her.
That you never see, that's right.
It's a free-floating voice not assigned to any bearer, he says. The voice of an unidentified soprano practicing scales. This mysterious voice does not originate from a person visible through the window, so the camera never shows the singer. On account of this feature, it is on account of this feature that Rear Window announces The Man Who Knew Too Much, Psycho, and The Birds. This voice transmutes first into the awkwardly pathetic song by means of which Doris Day reaches her kidnapped son.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be
That's in Man Who Knew Too Much. Then into the voice of the dead mother taking possession of Norman Bates. In Psycho.
until it finally dissolves into the chaotic croaking of the birds. In the birds.
Yeah, the movement of the voice in these films.
Yeah.
Because the birds has no score.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's known for not having a score.
Okay, but here's, you know, this is what Zizek was talking about. This feature which sticks out, both here in this sort of disembodied voice, you could say, but also this formal procedure of Hitchcock's that Zizek makes a lot of, that I think is typically associated with you know, the artistic qualities of Hitchcock's films, is the Hitchcock's tracking shots.
Yeah, this is, yeah, the tracking shot, which is the, like, a kind of formal continuity within Hitchcock, which manifests as a theme, right? So, like, like, yes, there's a particular tracking shot in these films, but what Zizek is saying is kind of crucial to Hitchcock as such is the tracking shot. And he actually describes how Hitchcock would often, in his films, imagine a kind of formal movement and then fill in the plot. So the plot was
so good. Yeah.
Somewhat subservient to the form itself.
Yeah, because Hitchcock was asked why he doesn't improvise on set. And he's like, because I write down my films on paper first. It's like, you don't accuse an architect. You don't ask an architect why they don't improvise. He's like, they draw the building first.
Amazing. Did he say the architect part?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Great.
He had two examples. The other, the architect and something else. The other one was cool as well. I just can't remember it. But yeah, there's a cool bit just here in the essay where it's like, it's a woman with her eyes pecked out in the birds. Like, there's a woman with her eyes pecked out.
The neighbor has his eyes pecked out.
His eyes, right.
Yeah.
So he talks about that tracking shot. So there's the advancing of the shot of the pecked out eyes, and it's too fast for details, which frustrates our desire to see everything. So skipping over the time for understanding. So
yeah,
the funny thing about that is not really a tracking shot in the way that we would think of it, right?
Mm-hmm. No. And so the point is that it starts. Phallic. It starts with the phallic because something's sticking out, and then it moves to the oral, which is like the desire to see everything, and then it moves to the anal because there's no time to pause to digest.
Yeah. So, like, she enters the room, the mother of all people, and sees him. You see what she sees initially. It's kind of hard exactly to see what she's saying, and then there's three jump cuts, like, into the eyes, basically. And it's shocking. It's actually, like, quite a successful technique. And then she starts to scream, but her voice is caught in her throat. She can't scream. But she runs down the hall, and then she runs out to her son, I believe. And there's an interesting pair here with the eyes as kind of holes of, like, these nothingness and her open mouth.
Yeah. Ooh, so again, right. silence functions as the horrifying menace, right? So no soundtrack in the birds and the silent scream.
Mm-hmm.
So just like in the previous episode, like, that's the subjectivity.
Yeah. Yeah. We think of, you know, the eyes and the voice as some, you know, the most human parts of us. And here we're getting the absence of those things.
Yeah. The horror of staring into somebody's eyes and seeing the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
This is the point of the stain too, in that, like, the double meaning of the hollowed out eyes, right? It's not just this, you know, grotesque scene of the birds pecking out this figure's eyes. It confers on it a supplementary meaning, makes the interpretive movement work.
Yeah, because, you know, what is it like? Eyes are the windows to the soul, and then if you remove the eyes, you just see this hollowed out depth.
And of course, the anus is the rear window to the soul.
What was the Reddit comment? Like, why are you guys so obsessed with our stuff? And I was like, no, we're not. And then I was like, actually, there's a lot.
Is there?
Well, in, like, only that episode or just in general?
What came to mind was ASSMR and episode.
thank you concerned listener. We'll take your criticisms to heart, and we will no longer talk about butt stuff.
So Zizek's saying here that the Hitchcockian tracking shot that produces the blot on an idyllic picture is achieved as though to illustrate the Lacanian thesis, the field of reality rests upon the extraction of the objet a, which nevertheless frames it. This is a tough point, but it's a pretty great one. Mm-hmm.
The diagram really helps. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, it's a little tough to explain without it, but
it's the, so I'll just describe the diagram. I'll try to. It's a rectangle with a smaller square cut out of it that's slotted out. And then that square is posed on the outside as objet A.
Mm-hmm.
And so in taking out this piece, this objet A, the piece comes to frame reality, mm-hmm. which is a perfect description of this, of the subject position. The want of being, the whole in being, comes into frame being itself through that gap in being.
Through this whole, as being, it is nothing but the subtracted bit, whence the equivalency of the subject and the object. That's so, Miller that he's referencing there.
Yeah.
And the point is that the presence itself confers, sorry, the absence itself confers a presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, in Rear Window, this is the window.
Yeah.
The window frame is the object, in a sense, of his desire, the contents, which completely reframe his relation to Grace Kelly.
It's an object which is also a frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, fantasy frame.
By showing us the heterogeneous element that must remain an inert, nonsensical blot in the rest of the picture is to acquire the consistency of a symbolic reality.
Enjoy the music for a minute.
I guess the fundamental point that he's making about these tracking shots is that with his tracking shots, Hitchcock is changing the field itself. So in place of montage, he produces a radical discontinuity, the shifting from reality to the real produced by the very continuous movement of the tracking shot. That is, the tracking movement can be described as moving from an overall view of reality to its point of anamorphosis. So in this tracking shot down to Ingrid Bergman, you're seeing it from above, this kind of like bird's eye view, apparently, into the point of the key, which inscribes you as the viewer into the symbolic space of this film. Well, it's interesting that it's a key.
Some sort of key to the
plot. Yeah. Go from like a bird's eye view to a key.
Yeah, he says
one more quote here. The Hitchcockian object par excellence, the non-specularizable object of exchange, the piece of the real that circulates from one subject to another, embodying and guaranteeing the structural network of symbolic exchanges between them.
Oh yeah, okay. So there's Zizek talks about a few different types. There's the hystericized tracking shot, the one that jumps into the neighbor's eyes. There's the reverse tracking shot, which begins with a kind of uncanny detail, which pulls back the overall view of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the immobile tracking shot, which is probably Zizek's most famous example of this. In the birds, when there's been the fire in the gas station. And then from above, we kind of get the picture of the scene, the objective picture, which becomes twisted when birds enter the scene.
Yeah. And so it's like from a bird's eye view, mm-hmm. in this generic sense, into a like the birds as like what they are in the film, the bird's eye view. Maybe I'm making too much of that, but
yeah, what he calls a radical subjectivization. So like it seems to be from a what he calls a metalinguistic distance, and then it gets subjectivized by the birds.
Yeah.
The threatening gaze of the birds.
And it's interesting because from street level, when you see this happen, it seems to require this tracking shot in order to fully understand what's going the action below. And then no sooner do you think you understand the scene, then you realize that your point of view as a viewer is actually the bird's point of view.
To this scene. And I thought it was good also when Zizek is setting up the scenario, he's describing it. He talks about how there's the character when the gas is flooding away. and the people were in the restaurant looking at where the gas is going. There's this guy lighting, Zizek says he's lighting a cigarette, but it's funny because in the movie, it's actually a cigar. It's very obviously a cigar. So, you know, sometimes a cigar is a cigarette.
This just brings to mind something quite cool. And I've read Tarantino's book, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I read it as well.
Yeah,
I thought it was good.
It's good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I'm actually excited for more from him. But there's a really cool part where he's talking about us, Rosemary's Baby, and who's the director?
Polanski.
Roma. Yeah. So yeah, he's talking to him. He's giving a bit of film history, but because this is true. But Roman Polanski intentionally shot a scene in Rosemary's Baby. Like, you get kind of in the center of the screen is the border of a door. There's the wall and the door, and there's a and Rosemary is kind of to the right on the door, like behind, like in the room. And when he was asked, why aren't you just shooting, like, you know, centering Rosemary in the scene, and to which Polanski is like, oh, you'll see later. But and then when they were sitting in the back of the first screening of the film, the whole audience moved to the right as if to peer around the door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a good example of what we're talking about, where like you as the viewer become like implicated into the scene.
Mm-hmm.
As if you are not aware that you're viewing something like a film, you're devouring with your eyes. You actually think that you have some sort of control over what's happening. Well, the shot, yeah. I mean, we're basically talking about how, like, via the tracking shot or this technique, what is objective becomes subjectivized. You as a viewer kind of enter the scene,
mm-hmm.
in the same way that, you know, you kind of occupy the bird's position.
Okay, so another theme that Zizek discusses here, kind of for the rest of the essay actually, is the function of the mother in North by Northwest, Psycho, and The Birds. Actually, there's a fourth too. The fourth one I have not seen, which is which one is that?
The Wrong Man.
Yeah, The Wrong Man.
I haven't seen it either.
Anyway, that's the one where Zizek thinks it doesn't work because the opening scene is where Hitchcock is describing what you're about to see. It's like too overdetermined by the intent of what he wants you to get. Yeah, so he says, what we must bear in mind is the libidinal content of this Hitchcockian stain. Although its logic is phallic, it announces an agency that perturbs and hinders the rule of the name of the father. In other words, the stain maternalizes the maternal superego. Yeah, so he says, to prove this, let's give the example of the birds. Like, why are the birds attacking? So, like, there's a cool kind of way he approaches this example. He's like, let's imagine the birds without the birds.
Mm-hmm.
It would be kind of like an average American melodrama.
Yeah,
it would be about
Tennessee Williams or something.
Yeah, and really, the first half of the movie is exactly this. It's just a woman who meets a man and wants to convince the man's mother that she's like worth it.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Yeah, Hitchcock considered making the movie without birds.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So yeah, and then why do the birds attack? There's a few explanations. There's
a cosmological, ecological, and familial interpretation.
The cosmological being the world is peaceful on the surface, but below brews the potential for the dark world to ignite and punish us. And there's the ecological one, the birds of the world unite. And what was the last one, Michael?
Familial,
yeah. Which I think Zizek points to as the convincing interpretation, that the birds attack because they manifest as the mother's protection against the sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the woman first meets the mother is very cold and like assessing, and they actually look like each other, which I think is probably intentional.
Yeah, so this is like there's this function of the mother in a number of Hitchcock's films. At the beginning of North by Northwest, Roger Thornhill receives a call from his mother, calls his mother, and she's kind of this like she's external to the the drama of the film, but it's clear that his relation to her is she's a sort of like parenthetical yet present force in his life that he feels as though he has to live up to in some way. And through these references to the maternal function, I think you named it a second ago, Michael, like there's this punitive, harsh, superegoic function of the mother in Hitchcock's films.
And all these characters are without fathers as well.
Yeah, right. So like in Psycho, Norman Bates tries to directly occupy the role of his mother.
Yeah, so if we look at it as a triad, I think it goes North by Northwest, Psycho, Birds, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In North by Northwest, the mother is, like we were talking about with The Voice, kind of off screen,
mm-hmm.
And yet plays kind of, has a kind of watchful eye on her son.
Mm-hmm.
So then he, in the second, in Psycho, the mother is dead, and yet he kind of acts her out. That is a spoiler, I'm sorry.
Yeah, like he impersonates her voice.
Yeah, because he kills the mother's boyfriend and then the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she lives within him as a voice.
And then
she's still a voice. In both films, she's a voice.
Yeah.
A little fruity, aren't you?
And then in The Birds, the mother is there as a harsh, like, superegoic figure, but nonetheless protective. A kind of real protective. Anyone can comprehend this type, you know, this function of the mother. And yet, there is this excessive element of The Birds.
Yeah, so he talks about it as a failed symbolization. So it's not that the birds are symbols, but they play a direct part in the story as something outside of the like rational chain of events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is actually same. There's a similar trajectory in terms of mothers in these three films with birds. So in North by Northwest, we get the steel bird scene where he's running away from an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Then in Psycho, there's a room full of stuffed birds.
Mm-hmm. And even his mother's preserved corpse is reminiscent, he says, of a kind of taxidermied bird.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, we get birds in Birds,
which I think if you're going, you know, if you're doing like a film program in university, you would be a very smart guy if you said the birds symbolize the mother. And Zizek is careful here to parse the distinction between the birds directly symbolizing the mother. He says they actually don't symbolize the mother.
No.
They are rather, he says, the making present in the real. The objectivization, the incarnation of the fact that on the symbolizing level, something has not worked out. In short, the objectivization, positivization of a failed symbolization.
Mm-hmm. But the positivization of the failure for the two characters to fuck.
Is that it? I thought.
Yeah, so I think it's the positivization of there is no sexual relationship. I think that's what he's saying.
Okay, that's yeah, that's good. But then what's the role of the mother in that?
Well, the mother ensuring that they do not.
I see. Yeah. So the birds aren't symbols of the mother, but they're the kind of like it's a presence of an absence. I think you could say like it's the,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's the instantiation of it.
Uh huh.
As a schoolboy at a Catholic school, he was a notorious purloiner of eggs that he would steal from a priest, and then he would throw them at church windows. And when the priest caught him, he said, "I don't know, Father. It looks like the birds have been flying overhead."
I mean, kind of what Zizek is saying here that is that, like, it's kind of subtle, actually, but he's talking about basically the breakdown of the paternal function in mid-century America, England. He says, "The deficient paternal ego ideal makes the law regress toward a ferocious maternal superego affecting sexual enjoyment." And that as a description of Hitchcock's films, specifically these three films, is very interesting. And I think it's also interesting that in England, you know, the birds or birds is a term for women.
And this is Zizek's greater point about the ideological change in, you know, the later 20th century towards this maternal manifestation of power.
Yeah. So he says in the form of like the postmodern boss, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
He says that in this, so quoting Zizek here, he says, today's permissive society is certainly not less repressive than the epoch of the organization man, that obsessive servant of the bureaucratic institution. The sole difference lies in the fact that in a society that demands submission to the rules of social intercourse, but refuses to ground those rules in a code of moral conduct in the ego ideal, the social demands the form of a harsh, punitive superego.
Yeah, like this is, yeah, this is totally tracks with much of what we talked about in terms of the way that ideology acts upon you now, rather than being a kind of force enforcement mm-hmm. of a law. It's the suggestion that you should follow the law because you want to.
Yeah. Rather than prohibition of enjoyment, it's the enjoyment of prohibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very nice. I wonder if we can touch on this one more time. The ultimate incarnation of Hitchcock of the, in Hitchcock of the bad object as the counterpart to the reigned maternal law. So like the birds here are the counterpart to the, you know, this superegoic law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's precisely this conjunction of the bad object of fascination and the maternal law that defines the kernel of the Hitchcockian fantasy.
I think that's where we're getting at.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Well, let's be honest, it's what Zizek is getting at. We didn't come up with this shit.
True, yeah.
It's interesting because people assume that psychoanalysis, like Hitchcock, is a phallocentric interpretive model, mm-hmm. right? But Zizek is using psychoanalysis here to explain this maternal law.
Yeah, the way in which the maternal law acts, yeah, like in film and in the world, and that neither the phallus nor the maternal law is to be understood purely on like gendered terms exactly, right? Because the phallus is merely a
non-biological,
point of absence upon which things are ordered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also this is a part of Zizek going against Mulvey, who is, you know, basically the predominant, she has the predominant use of psychoanalysis in film studies, which Todd McGowan.
She's the male gaze one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you were like, I'm sure much has been made of Rear Window and the male gaze.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, this Zizek is talking about here, this kind of disruptive element, which he's, you know, he's finding in the figure of the mother in Hitchcock's films very interesting. Like in Rear Window, this disembodied, extraneous element that gains more and more force in Hitchcock's films, in the preceding films, to the point where it becomes this, you know, frenetic, intense attack.
Yeah, and each one, yeah, and like he makes a point like if you take each one on its own terms, you're not going to get this. You have to view Hitchcock kind of serially to understand it.
Right.
Shout out to Ryan. Well, that's probably a good point. I mean, by no means did we exhaust the Zizek's work on Hitchcock. There's a lot more to talk about.
We could do maybe the next patron one, or though I feel like a public Hitchcock one would be good too. We'd approach it via like a specific film besides The Birds.
We could do a whole episode on Vertigo, I think.
Yeah. And North by Northwest too. He talks a lot about that one.
Mm. Cool.
Cool. Talk to you guys soon. Talk to you next week.
Yeah, talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.